SEIU paid and Obama played. Within 2 weeks of moving into the White House, Obama immediately signed a series of executive orders championed by union bosses. The new rules authorize sweeping powers to the Labor Secretary that essentially blackball non-union contractors targeted by labor organizers and blacklist non-union employees in the private sector from working on taxpayer-funded projects. Such regulatory favoritism limits freedom in the workplace and raises the cost of doing business. Another measure immediately adopted by President Obama requires that when a government service contract runs out and there's a new contract to perform the same service at the same location, the new contractor must retain the old workers. Mickey Kaus of the left-leaning Slate magazine dubbed the move the labor payoff of the day. President Obama and Vice President Biden invited labor leaders to join them for a public ceremony, unveiling the executive orders repealing Bush policies that had reined in big labor. "Welcome back to the White House," Biden gloated. Who authored the orders? Carter Wood of the National Association of Manufacturers traced the original executive order files to Craig Becker, legal counsel for the SEIU and member of Obama's transition team for labor issues. In May 2009, the Los Angeles Times reported that the White House had included the SEIU in a conference call with California government officials over federal stimulus money. State officials said the union pressured them to repeal a bipartisan-approved wage cut for home health care workers as a condition for receiving the federal funds. An Obama lawyer for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which regulates home health care, sided with the SEIU and concluded that California arguments in defense of the wage cuts were unsupportable. The feds later backed off, but not before Andy Stern's union received unprecedented access to negotiations. When Obama promised the SEIU conference to open up the doors of government and ask you to be involved, he meant it. Patrick Gaspard, former chief lobbyist for SEIU's behemoth New York healthcare affiliate Local 1199, served as Obama's campaign national political director and transition deputy director personnel. During the 2004 election cycle, he had led the radical left-wing George Soros-funded group America Coming Together, ACT, as national field director. SEIU poured $23 million into ACT in a costly, unsuccessful attempt to put Democratic Senator John Kerry in the White House. Under Gaspard's tenure at ACT, the Get Out the Vote group employed convicted felons as canvassers and committed campaign finance violations that led to a $775,000 fine by the Federal Election Commission, the third largest civil penalty levied in the panel's history. Gaspard was appointed White House political director shortly after Election Day 2008. Obama named two of SEIU's favored candidates to top cabinet posts, Kansas Democrat Governor Kathleen Sebelius to head the Department of Health and Human Services, and California Democrat Representative Hilda Solis to head the Department of Labor. She probably will be the labor secretary that has been on more picket lines and rallied in more support of workers' rights than potentially anyone in American history, Stern gushed in his endorsement of the SEIU's handpicked candidate, Solis. When the Solis nomination ran into trouble over her husband's unpaid tax liens and lobbying activities, recall Chapter 4 for more details, the SEIU war machine turned up the heat, blasting emails, petitions, and a YouTube protest video from Stern. Republicans yielded. Upon her confirmation on February 24, 2009, the union crowed, SEIU pushed for Hilda Solis to be confirmed as Secretary of Labor and took action to urge others to join in. More than 10,000 people called for Hilda Solis to be confirmed as our next Secretary of Labor, and now she has been. Less than a month after taking the oath of office in January, Obama awarded SEIU President Stern with a prominent place at the table for a fiscal responsibility summit focusing on health care. A delighted Stern basked in presidential approval at the summit when Obama called on him to make a statement and then complimented the union boss on his jaunty purple scarf. Stern also boasted via Twitter, the microblogging social network, that he was a special guest at one of the White House Wednesday cocktail parties. The social gathering of union leaders and other left-wing groups was organized by Obama crony and chief advisor Valerie Jarrett to coordinate the message on progressive legislation such as card check. A few weeks later, Stern was invited to speak at Vice President Biden's task force on the middle class kickoff. Not long after that, Stern, SEIU Secretary Treasurer Anna Berger, and SEIU Healthcare Chair Dennis Rivera gave input during the White House Healthcare Summit. Obama also appointed Berger to the President's Economic Recovery Advisory Board to provide advice on boosting the sagging U.S. economy. The SEIU Secretary Treasurer praised Obama as a politician who does not turn a deaf ear to the hurts and hopes of working people. He is a president who sees members of labor unions as part of the solution, too. She complimented Team Obama for showing the leadership necessary to address the challenges working families face in a 21st century global economy and create economic recovery that works for everyone, not just those at the top. So much for the lofty rhetoric. But for all the talk of change, SEIU represents the very essence of top-down corruption and business as usual funded by the compulsory dues of its workers. The Competitive Enterprise Institute's Ivan Osorio reported that since abandoning the AFL-CIO in 2005, SEIU Stern has sought to assert his union's influence over private equity firms, centralize his authority within the union by forcing various locals to merge, and negotiate large deals with employers without member participation. Three of Stern's hand-picked operatives were forced to step down in 2008-2009 over financial scandals. The union's own rank-and-file members have revolted in disgust over mismanagement and thuggery. In March 2009, the SEIU notified the local that represents its Washington, D.C.-based national field staff and community organizers that a third of them would be laid off. The Union of Union Representatives, as the local is known, lodged an unfair labor practices complaint against the SEIU, alleging that it laid off workers without proper notice, banned union activities, and hired temporary workers. SEIU's top brass insisted with straight faces that, after burning through $85 million of the workers' dues to elect Barack Obama, the powerful union can't afford to keep paying 75 of its national field staffers because of budget troubles. In a delicious, petard-hoisting moment, the laid-off union workers protested outside SEIU headquarters in Washington, chanting, "How do you spell hypocrisy? S-E-I-U." Like the Obama White House, SEIU's brass embraces a policy of self-exemption on ethics, transparency, and fiscal responsibility. Do as they say, not as they do. The Blago SEIU Obama Convergence. The Illinois crew and the SEIU friends that Obama so effusively praised are integral parts of the tainted Chicago political machine. In December 2008, those ties came under national scrutiny when federal prosecutors publicly released their criminal complaint against disgraced former governor of Illinois, Democrat Rod Blagojevich. SEIU figured prominently in Blago's secretly taped musings on how to profit from his power to appoint Obama's Senate replacement. So did a larger union umbrella federation, Change to Win, led by SEIU Secretary Treasurer Anna Berger. Blago hatched a plan to snag a $300,000-a-year job as head of Change to Win in exchange for appointing a union-friendly successor to Obama. The SEIU backed Blago for governor in 2002. SEIU's Political Action Committee donated $821,294 for his successful gubernatorial bid. In the 2005-2006 season, the SEIU Illinois Council PAC was the governor's top contributor in his reelection effort, with $908,382 in donations. All told, according to research by the National Right to Work Foundation, union PACs poured more than $8 million into Blagojevich's two gubernatorial campaign coffers, $1.7 million alone from the SEIU. In return, Blagojevich delivered an executive order, clearing the path for SEIU to unionize nearly 50,000 home child care providers subsidized by taxpayers. He signed another executive order facilitating union organizing on public university campuses. At the time of his arrest, Blago was preparing another executive order to expand the union organizing abilities of an even larger portion of home health care workers targeted by the SEIU. Blagojevich did the country an extraordinary unintended favor. As healthcare analyst David Catron wrote, he's made it clear to the meanest intelligence that President Obama emerged from a hopelessly corrupt political culture. Barack Obama oozed from the same stinking Chicago swamp that produced Blagojevich, and a man whose formative years were spent wallowing in the muck with such creatures isn't likely to be long in the White House before the stench of pay-to-play politics begins to pervade the place. FBI Special Agent Daniel W. Kane detailed Blago's conversations with Chief of Staff John Harris revolving around the SEIU and the federal criminal complaint, which documented a laundry list of charges of conspiracy to commit fraud and solicitation to commit bribery. 98. On November 7, 2008, Rod Blagojevich talked with Advisor A about the Senate seat. Rod Blagojevich stated that he is willing to trade the Senate seat to Senate Candidate 1 in exchange for the position of Secretary of Health and Human Services in the President-elect's cabinet. 99. Later, on November 7, 2008, Rod Blagojevich discussed the open Senate seat in a three-way call with John Harris and Advisor B, a Washington, D.C.-based consultant. Rod Blagojevich indicated in the call that if he was appointed as Secretary of Health and Human Services by the President-elect, then Rod Blagojevich would appoint Senate Candidate 1 to the open Senate seat. Harris stated, "We wanted our ask to be reasonable and rather than make it look like some sort of selfish grab for a quid pro quo." Rod Blagojevich stated that he needs to consider his family and that he is financially hurting. Harris said that they are considering what will help the financial security of the Blagojevich family and what will keep Rod Blagojevich politically viable. Rod Blagojevich stated, "I want to make money." During the call, Rod Blagojevich, Harris, and Advisor B discussed the prospect of working a three-way deal for the open Senate seat. Harris noted that Rod Blagojevich is interested in taking a high-paying position with an organization called Change to Win, which is connected to Service Employees International Union, SEIU. Harris suggested that SEIU official make Rod Blagojevich the head of Change to Win, and in exchange, the president-elect could help Change to Win with its legislative agenda on a national level. Advisor B asked why SEIU official cannot just give the job to Rod Blagojevich. Harris responded that it would be just a big giveaway for SEIU official and Change to Win since there are already individuals on the Change to Win payroll doing the functions of the position that would be created for Rod Blagojevich. Harris said that Change to Win will want to trade the job for Rod Blagojevich for something from the president-elect. Harris suggested a three-way deal and explained that a three-way deal like the one discussed would give the president-elect a buffer, so there's no obvious quid pro quo for Senate Candidate 1. Rod Blagojevich stated that for him to give up the governorship for the Change to Win position, the Change to Win position must pay a lot more than he's getting paid right now. Advisor B said that he liked the idea of the three-way deal. Rod Blagojevich stated that he's interested in making $250,000 to $300,000 and being on some organization boards. Advisor B said they should leverage the president-elect's desire to have Senate Candidate 1 appointed to the Senate seat in order to get a head position with Change to Win and a salary. Advisor B agreed that the three-way deal would be a better plan than Rod Blagojevich appointing Senate Candidate 2 to the Senate seat and getting more done as governor. The conniving governor contemplated an SEIU position for his wife Patty as well. 100. Also, Rod Blagojevich wanted to know whether SEIU could do something to get his wife a position at Change to Win until Rod Blagojevich could take a position at Change to Win.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Harris mapped out a three-way deal to give the White House a buffer, obscuring the obvious quid pro quo. SEIU would assist Obama with Blago's appointment of a union-friendly candidate. Blago would get his cushy union job, and SEIU would be rewarded down the road with favors from the White House. 101. C. Rod Blagojevich said that the consultants, Advisor B and another consultant, are believed to be on the call at that time, are telling him that he has to suck it up for 2 years and do nothing and give this motherfucker, the president-elect, his senator. Fuck him for nothing. Fuck him. Rod Blagojevich states that he will put Senate Candidate 4 in the Senate before I just give fucking Senate Candidate 1 a fucking Senate seat and I don't get anything. Senate Candidate 4 is a deputy governor of the state of Illinois. Rod Blagojevich stated that he needs to find a way to take the financial stress off of his family and that his wife is as qualified or more qualified than another specifically named individual to sit on corporate boards. According to Rod Blagojevich, the immediate challenge is how do we take some of the financial pressure off of our family? Later in the phone call, Rod Blagojevich stated that absent getting something back, Rod Blagojevich will not pick Senate Candidate 1. Harris restated Rod Blagojevich's thoughts that they should ask the president-elect for something for Rod Blagojevich's financial security as well as maintain his political viability. Harris said they could work out a three-way deal with SEIU and the president-elect, or SEIU could help the president-elect with Rod Blagojevich's appointment of Senate Candidate 1 to the vacant Senate seat. Rod Blagojevich would obtain a position as the national director of the Change to Win campaign, and SEIU would get something favorable from the president-elect in the future. D. One of Rod Blagojevich's advisors said he likes the idea. It sounds like a good idea, but advised Rod Blagojevich to be leery of promises for something 2 years from now. Rod Blagojevich's wife said they would take the job now. Thereafter, Rod Blagojevich and others on the phone call discussed various ways Rod Blagojevich can monetize the relationships he is making as governor to make money after Rod Blagojevich is no longer governor. A few days later, Team Blago reached out to the SEIU. An unnamed SEIU official agreed to float their plan and see where it goes. 109. On November 12, 2008, Rod Blagojevich spoke with SEIU official who was in Washington, D.C. Prior intercepted phone conversations indicate that approximately a week before this call, Rod Blagojevich met with SEIU official to discuss the vacant Senate seat, and Rod Blagojevich understood that SEIU official was an emissary to discuss Senate Candidate 1's interest in the Senate seat. During the conversation with SEIU official on November 12, 2008, Rod Blagojevich informed SEIU official that he had heard the president-elect wanted persons other than Senate Candidate 1 to be considered for the Senate seat. SEIU official stated that he would find out if Senate Candidate 1 wanted SEIU official to keep pushing her for senator with Rod Blagojevich. Rod Blagojevich said that one thing I'd be interested in is a 501c4 organization. Rod Blagojevich explained the 501c4 idea to SEIU official and said that the 501c4 could help our new senator candidate 1. SEIU official agreed to put that flag up and see where it goes. 110. On November 12, 2008, Rod Blagojevich talked with Advisor B. Rod Blagojevich told Advisor B that he told SEIU official, I said go back to Senate Candidate 1 and say, hey, look, if you still want to be a senator and don't rule us out, and then broach the idea of this 501c4 with her. Senate Candidate 1 was top Obama advisor and Chicago political godmother Valerie Jarrett, who removed herself from the running when she took a top White House advisor post instead. Who was the SEIU official Team Blago spoke with and met? The Wall Street Journal obtained an internal communication in December 2008 fingering President Obama's homeboy SEIU Local 1 president, Tom Balanoff. The New York Times then followed up with a report that several union officials in Chicago and Washington also identified Balanoff as the official who spoke to Blago. Balanoff, not coincidentally, had been appointed by Blago to the Illinois Health Facilities Planning Board. 2 days before Christmas 2008, legal counsel Greg Craig released an official report outlining contacts between Team Obama and Team Blago. Balanoff, it turns out, had spoken with Jarrett. On November 7, 2008, at a time when she was still a potential candidate for the Senate seat, Ms. Jarrett spoke with Mr. Tom Balanoff, the head of the Illinois chapter of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. Mr. Balanoff is not a member of the governor's staff and did not purport to speak for the governor on that occasion. But because the subject of the governor's interest in a cabinet appointment came up in that conversation, I am including a description of that meeting. Mr. Balanoff told Ms. Jarrett that he had spoken to the governor about the possibility of selecting Valerie Jarrett to replace the president-elect. He told her that Lisa Madigan's name also came up. Ms. Jarrett recalls that Mr. Balanoff also told her that the governor had raised with him the question of whether the governor might be considered as a possible candidate to head up the Department of Health and Human Services in the new administration. Mr. Balanoff told Ms. Jarrett that he told the governor that it would never happen. Jarrett concurred. Mr. Balanoff did not suggest that the governor, in talking about HHS, was linking a position for himself in the Obama cabinet to the selection of the president-elect's successor in the Senate. And Ms. Jarrett did not understand the conversation to suggest that the governor wanted the cabinet seat as a quid pro quo for selecting any specific candidate to be the president-elect's replacement. At no time did Balanoff say anything to her about offering Blagojevich a union position. It strains credulity to believe that a seasoned Chicago poll such as Jarrett did not understand that a gobsmackingly obvious quid pro quo was being suggested to her at the behest of Blagojevich. Jarrett claims complete ignorance of any scheming, but note from the criminal complaint cited above that Blagojevich understood that the SEIU official was an emissary to discuss Senate Candidate 1's, Valerie Jarrett's, interest in the Senate seat, and that the SEIU official stated that he would find out if Senate Candidate 1 wanted the SEIU official to keep pushing her for senator with Blagojevich. Obama counsel Greg Craig stuck to the story in a media conference call discussing the Obama administration's self-exonerating report. Q. Okay. And then why did Valerie Jarrett characterize this as a ridiculous proposition? Mr. Craig. She thought it was ridiculous for the governor of Illinois to be talking about being appointed to Barack Obama's cabinet at a time when he was under investigation, widely reported in the newspapers, under investigation for a variety of problems. And the reason that I believe that she thought it was ridiculous and said so was because that's what she told her counsel, and that's what her counsel told me. Q. And did she, at that point, or did anyone else, in the course of her communications with, you know, folks perceived to be communicating for Blagojevich, raise a red flag and say, hey, you know, guess what? Balanoff just told me that, you know, this ridiculous thing that Blagojevich wanted to be HHS secretary. Mr. Craig, well, she did not perceive Balanoff to be communicating as an emissary of Governor Blagojevich. She conceived of him as being a union official who had met with the governor, and this topic came up, but it was not presented to her as a quid pro quo. In January 2009, the Associated Press, Wall Street Journal, and other news organizations reported that SEIU President Andy Stern and Balanoff had met personally with Blagojevich on November 3rd, right around the time the feds alleged the governor was hatching his pay-for-play schemes. Balanoff spoke with Blago a total of three times, on November 3rd, November 6th, the day before Balanoff met with Jarrett, and November 12th. Balanoff announced in mid-February 2009 that he was cooperating with the feds. SEIU flacks have taken pains to emphasize that no one has yet alleged any illegality on the union's part. Defiantly standing by his union's past support of the impeached governor, Stern insisted he had no reason to believe anyone did anything wrong, but blanket denials can't cover the cesspool stench. Does the SEIU deserve the benefit of the doubt? A review of the union's sordid history of corruption over the past few years suggests otherwise. Stern has been responsible for installing a cabal of hand-chosen officers who exploited their cash-infused fiefdoms for personal gain and presided over rigged elections, in the process becoming all that they had professed to stand against as representatives of the downtrodden worker. Living large in L.A., Andy Stern rallied the Illinois delegation to the 2008 Democratic National Convention in August 2008 with an impassioned salute to the working man. Flanking Stern on stage at the Denver celebration, Chicago political machine kingpins Rahm Emanuel and Richard Daley. Stern roared about rebalancing power between wealth and work to make sure everyone shares in the wealth of a growing economy. echoing Obama's 2007 speech to the SEIU Political Action Conference, union boss Stern condemned the old way of doing business and called on America to turn the page on behalf of hardworking Americans and their families. But just 2 weeks before Stern and company gathered in the Mile High City to celebrate Obama's coronation, the Los Angeles Times published an explosive investigative series about the SEIU. Although the series got surprisingly little attention from national news organizations, LA Times reporters exposed how one of Stern's top protégés shared in the wealth by siphoning off hundreds of thousands of dollars in dues money for his personal enrichment and pleasure. Moreover, the paper alleged Stern helped cover up the scandal. No wonder they keep urging us to turn the page. The LA Times investigation zeroed in on Tyrone Freeman, who, like Barack Obama, began his career as an urban community organizer. In Atlanta, Freeman quickly ascended the SEIU ladder. In 1994, Stern found him at a small Georgia chapter of the Union, Local 1985, and brought him westward. Stern set his loyalist Freeman up as head of Local 6434, the sprawling home care workers chapter in Southern California that represents an estimated 160,000 workers who make about $9 an hour caring for the elderly and disabled. Stern chose Freeman as part of his administration slate at the SEIU convention in 2008 and named him a national vice president in addition to the LA appointment. The move wasn't an altruistic act of affirmative action. It was part of Stern's grander plan to consolidate power by merging locals into statewide chapters. With bigger membership roles came bigger coffers, and with bigger coffers came irresistible temptations. Freeman, the LA Times discovered, had piped $600,000 in union contracts to his wife's video production and entertainment ventures. The local also paid his mother-in-law $8,000 a month to babysit his daughter and other union employees' children, footed a $13,000 bill for membership at a Beverly Hills cigar club, covered $12,500 in tabs at upscale Morton's restaurant in Burbank, and forked over $8,000 in union dues to cover expenses for Freeman's Hawaiian wedding. Freeman's spending orgy didn't end there. Stern's protege created a nonprofit training shop called the Home Care Workers Training Center, ostensibly to provide educational opportunities for nurses. In practice, the nonprofit served as a conduit to subsidize a child care business operated by Freeman's mother-in-law. Her business had been receiving more than $90,000 annually for the past several years from the training center that Freeman founded as a separate nonprofit and chairs, according to IRS filings and interviews by the LA Times. The funding from her son-in-law constituted more than 10% of the nonprofit's total yearly expenditures. Freeman's wife, Pilar, and brother-in-law, Hernando Planels Jr., are listed in state documents as officers in the mother-in-law's business. Freeman's ransacking of Local 6434's treasury didn't end with nepotistic favoritism, the Times also reported. A housing corporation that Freeman helped found as a nonprofit has not been granted the IRS tax-exempt status it sought and was suspended from doing business in California. It also has claimed on its website to have a strong relationship with the prominent California Community Foundation, which says it has no such relationship. The union spent at least $123,000 more on the fundraising tournament at the Four Seasons Resort in Carlsbad than it received in reimbursements, according to Labor Department filings and interviews. Freeman said the event made money for the charity. The union's expenditures included $100,000 in payments to entities associated with former professional football star Eric Dickerson, which had been suspended from doing business in California. The payments were listed as donations to nonprofits, not as fundraising expenses. And a now-defunct minor league basketball team, coached by Freeman's brother-in-law, received $16,000 for what the union described as public relations. Freeman's local also paid nearly $106,000 to a company called The Filming Incorporated, for which the Times could find no state incorporation record or IRS nonprofit listing, no business license, and no legitimate address, and another $106,000 to Hollywood talent agency William Morris for advice and counsel in such areas as media and membership awareness. Even more troubling, Freeman allegedly rigged his own election. In August 2008, the Labor Department began investigating charges from rank-and-file members that Freeman's union local made it nearly impossible for candidates not in his slate to qualify for the ballot, according to people familiar with the probe. The FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office also opened investigations. Former employees of Freeman's nonprofit charity also alleged that the Stern protege forced them to work on campaigns of political candidates in violation of federal law. Even more damning, a key union source told the Times that, contrary to the denials of union brass, SEIU's top officials were warned of Freeman's plundering 6 years before the paper blew the whistle. In response to the July 2008 inquiries, union spokesman Steve Trossman had issued a statement on behalf of Stern that said the union had received no allegations about Freeman's local. Freeman denied any wrongdoing. The source, who said he was party to internal conversations about Freeman in 2002, told the Times last week the International knew that there were allegations of impropriety many years ago. This is not news to them. On August 20, 2008, just days before Stern would join Democrats in toasting Barack Obama at the party convention in Denver, Stern's protege, Tyrone Freeman, stepped aside as head of Local 6434, and the chapter was placed in a temporary trusteeship. Stern's office in Washington, D.C., released the announcement. These allegations are of serious concern to all of us, and we support Mr. Freeman's decision to put the best interests of the members first. Stern spokeswoman Michelle Ringette wrote in an email to the Times. But even as he relinquished his position, Freeman was apparently engaging in the strong-arm tactics he learned from Stern. 10 employees told the Times that they suffered retaliation after refusing to sign a petition supporting him as the scandal exploded. Freeman's lieutenants at Local 6434 essentially pressured other members to sign a loyalty oath, one union member disclosed. After dragging its feet and being forced to act to quell public embarrassment over the Times investigations, SEIU finally announced formal charges against Freeman for engaging in self-dealing and financial malpractice in violation of SEIU's constitution and local bylaws. In November, Stern threw his underling under the bus. Freeman, whom Stern had groomed in his own image, was banned for life from the SEIU in order to provide $1.1 million in restitution to the union. A sanctimonious Stern issued a statement lamenting Freeman's downfall. Today's decision sends a clear message across our union. We are all accountable. Our members do some of the toughest jobs anywhere, and we will not tolerate any actions violating their trust or putting their interests at risk. But rank-and-file members weren't fooled or mollified. An insurgent group called SMART, Smart, SEIU Member Activists for Reform Today, blasted the union leadership. Freeman didn't come from nowhere. He was appointed by Andy Stern for the third time, and there are many other locals where Stern has installed unaccountable appointees and sometimes ignoring reports that they were out for personal gain. So Stern's message to us is clear. He cares more about expanding control for himself and an ever-shrinking inner circle than he does about building real power for working people, creating solid organizations, coming through on SEIU's political pledges for the fall, or even the perception of our union and our movement as real, democratic, valuable, and clean. He will only act when there is no other option, and he will never apologize. As for Freeman, he glided into a new life as a Los Angeles sports agent, where he uses his criminal involvement in defrauding low-wage workers as a selling point. His shameless biography on the website of the SMWW Sports Agency touts his tireless commitment to lead the struggle for livable wages, decent housing, and health care for all. Burnishing his scandal credentials, Freeman adds, I believe my recent personal experience, evolving from turmoil, can be a testimony shared in preparing any athlete for the trials and tribulations of being a star. Ruthless Andy Stern taught Tyrone Freeman and his Southern California peers all too well. Rickman Jackson, another Stern administration protege and former chief of staff to Tyrone Freeman, headed Michigan's largest SEIU chapter before being reassigned for 3 years to a staff organizing job after the revelation of financial shenanigans tied back to LA's Local 6434. While collecting a six-figure annual salary in Michigan, Jackson was drawing a second salary in California and accepted $33,500 in housing payments on a residence listed as the business address of Freeman's bogus housing nonprofit corporation. Another Stern administration protege, Anel Grajeda, rose to power after the SEIU president installed her as president of the 80,000-member Local 721 in Los Angeles. She ascended to positions on the Union State Council and International Executive Board. Like Freeman and Jackson, Grajeda had been voted onto Stern's official administration slate at the SEIU convention in 2008. The Times published damning details of how Grajeda's ex-boyfriend, SEIU official Alejandro Stevens, collected multiple salaries and consultant fees from the union while also pocketing a salary as a Los Angeles County Health Services employee. Grajeda had arranged for her ex-lover to get an 8-month leave of absence from the job. He was fired after he refused to return to work. Grajeda quit her California posts after catching public flack and found a new job as Special Assistant to SEIU Secretary Treasurer Anna Berger in Washington, D.C. Her former chapter heralded the move up. Grajeda will now oversee efforts to partner with the Obama administration to secure more public funds for SEIU projects. What could go wrong? Former SEIU 721 President Anel Grajeda assumed her new role as Special Assistant to the International Secretary Treasurer Anna Berger for the public sector March 9th. According to a staff announcement from the International Union in Washington, D.C. With more than 2 decades of service, Anel has played a critical role in winning strong contracts for tens of thousands of union members, preserving trauma centers in Los Angeles County, fighting for health care reform, defeating ballot initiatives in 2005 that challenged working families' livelihoods, and uniting more than 80,000 workers into SEIU 721 for greater strength and a stronger voice for public service providers. She brings this wealth of experience and talent to the national level in her new role. The International's announcement went on to state, while there has been no finding of wrongdoing on Anel's part, she has decided to change the capacity in which she serves the union in order to take on the challenge of developing quality public services at a time when funding is threatened like never before. In her new role, Anel will expand SEIU's work in the public sector, partnering with the Obama administration to secure more funds for key infrastructure projects and core public services, including care for the elderly, health care, education, and social services. Tyrone Freeman, Rickman, Jackson, and Anel Grajeda were all groomed by Stern and personally appointed by him to the posts they exploited. But there's no three-strikes policy in labor management. Like Obama, Stern has managed to pass the buck while pretending it stopped at his desk. Birds of a feather evade accountability together. A sea of purple payoffs. The LA SEIU debacles were just one stinking layer of Stern's rotten onion. Corruption isn't an anomaly at the SEIU, it's a contagion. Cronyism isn't the exception, it's the rule. LA Times reporter Paul Pringle relentlessly exposed additional cases of nepotism and backscratching, worth millions of dollars in compulsory union dues that benefited the consulting businesses, political nonprofits, and individuals with family or personal ties to top SEIU officials in Southern California and beyond. The SEIU and its political affiliate contributed $3 million to America Votes, an advocacy organization that was headed by Cecile Richards, wife of an aide to SEIU President Andy Stern, at the time the payments were made. Melissa Mullinax was an SEIU political director when the political consulting firm in which she held a 20-25% stake, the Edison Group, was paid more than $1 million, including expenses, by the union. In addition, the SEIU has spent about $41,000 on a graphic design company owned by Mullinax's husband, Jason Abbott. The union paid about $520,000 to a consulting firm co-founded by Democratic Party and labor strategist Steve Rosenthal, the husband of another SEIU director, Eileen Curlin. Rosenthal, a longtime friend of Stern, also headed America Coming Together, a get-out-the-vote nonprofit that received $23 million from the union. Pamela Kiefer, wife of a third union director, David Kiefer, has received about $70,000 in consulting fees and in separate payments from a firm that provided recruitment services to SEIU. In addition, the SEIU and an associated nonprofit paid roughly $210,000 in consulting fees over 4 years to Don Stillman, husband of the union's outside legal counsel, Judith Scott. Stillman helped edit a 2006 book written by Stern, a publication that has generated controversy because of how the union president profited from it. Although she is not an SEIU staffer, Scott disclosed her husband's relationship with the union on U.S. Labor Department disclosure forms filed by officers. A separate corruption case in the Bay Area uncovered another SEIU double dipper, James Bryant, who used a nonprofit run out of his home to line his pockets and his family's with extra union-funded income while also collecting a salary as a government transit worker. A Bay Area officer of the scandal-clouded Service Employees International Union has collected double salaries, one as a city transit worker and the other from a charity that receives much of its funding from the labor organization and corporate interests, records show. In addition, the nonprofit paid more than $16,000 in rent for the officer's home in 2007, the most recent year for which the charity's tax return is available, according to his son, who is also on the charity's payroll. James Bryant, who earned just under $68,000 as a transit station agent in 2007, received about $117,000 that year as president of the San Francisco chapter of the A. Philip Randolph Institute, according to the tax return in the city's Municipal Transportation Agency. He was also paid or reimbursed about $10,000 as an executive board member for SEIU Local 1021, whose political committee he chairs, the union's financial statements show. Bryant's son received $62,000 from the charity. His wife is also an employee of SEIU Local 1021. Compulsory union dues directly and indirectly paid the Bryant family's salary and rent with the help of the nonprofit, which was later decertified but continued to operate. The self-dealing scheme smelled as foul as the Sea Lion Hangout at San Francisco Bay's Pier 39. But the local cleared Bryant of any wrongdoing and vowed to move forward on behalf of the working men and women of Northern California. The union, nicknamed the Purple Ocean, is awash in purple payoffs and personal enrichment scams. Yet another high-ranking SEIU official was nabbed in February 2009 for bilking the union out of $9,000 for personal expenses. Adding salt to the wound, the officer Byron Hobbs, who served as an executive vice president of the SEIU's 90,000-member Illinois, Indiana healthcare local, had been assigned to serve as watchdog over a local in St. Louis that had been placed in trusteeship, basically a takeover of a local labor organization by its parent organization, which suspends the local chapter's autonomy and installs an outside monitor. In other words, Hobbs stole from the local chapter he'd been assigned to help clean up. A smug SEIU spokeswoman concluded that the case showed the system works. The system, however, has long enabled a den of union thieves to embezzle workers' dues for political and personal gain. In 2006, former Los Angeles City Councilman Martin Ludlow was sentenced to 5 years probation and 2,000 hours community service for his role in conspiring to scam SEIU Local 99, which represents nearly 40,000 public school teachers. Ludlow admitted to improperly using union money to pay six people who were put on the union payroll but who actually worked on his city council election campaign. The money also covered the cost of a cell phone he used in the campaign. Nearly $37,000 was diverted to his 2003 election campaign to underwrite the phantom union employee scheme. A year later, former president of SEIU Local 99, Janet Humphreys, was sentenced to 5 years probation in order to perform 1,000 hours of community service for her role in the embezzlement conspiracy. In addition to using teachers' dues to support Ludlow's campaign, Humphreys, a delegate to the 2004 Democratic National Convention, pleaded guilty to using union funds to pay for a trip to the Virgin Islands for her daughters and a family friend. She too had been installed to oversee a trusteeship at the local and left it under a darker cloud than when she arrived. As United States Attorney Deborah Wong Yang said in a statement following Humphrey's guilty plea, Corruption in organized labor strikes at the very heart of the benefits that unions bring. We owe working men and women our full commitment to root out corruption in public office and in organized labor. The persuasion of power. Asked about his organizing philosophy, Andy Stern summed it up this way. We prefer to use the power of persuasion, but if that doesn't work, we use the persuasion of power. Stern and his shock troops have bullied companies from private equity firms to Burger King to food management company Aramark, who have resisted SEIU's attempts to organize their workers. The Purple People have staged aggressive protests and a War on Greed campaign to intimidate employers into submission. One of the besieged targets, security provider Wackenhut Services, battled SEIU's attempts to gain exclusive representation for its employees. The company already had 10 other unions representing its workers. Initially unbowed by a massive, malicious, negative publicity campaign against them, Wackenhut blew the whistle. The SEIU seeks membership growth through aggressive corporate campaigns that have a blunt message to employers. Let us unionize your workforce or we will destroy your reputation. This tactic has been used against a number of organizations to include Walmart, Kaiser Permanente, Advocate Healthcare, Catholic Healthcare West, and Sutter Health. SEIU is attempting to coerce the Wackenhut Corporation and WSI to recognize it as the exclusive collective bargaining representative throughout Wackenhut. Wackenhut declined to enter into such an agreement. The SEIU responded with a corporate campaign that is intended to damage WSI's reputation and relationships with our clients. Their campaign tactics include distributing misinformation, distortion and omission of fact through the media, conducting demonstrations in proximity of work sites in an effort to disrupt normal client operations, and aggressively attempting to intimidate or influence clients. But after filing a racketeering lawsuit against the SEIU, a weary and drained Wackenhut entered into an agreement allowing its employees in 9 cities to choose SEIU as its bargaining representative. Behold the persuasion of power. Showing an appalling lack of concern for the well-being of its members, the SEIU upped the ante in a representation battle with the University of Miami in 2006, where Stern's organizers mounted a campus hunger strike. The union fought tooth and nail against a true democratic unionizing election for campus janitors using a secure, federally monitored secret ballot. Stern personally escalated the dispute, joined the Fasters, and demonized then-university president Donna Shalala. Yes, the same Donna Shalala who served in President Clinton's cabinet. She lashed back. We are devastated that the union is risking the health and well-being of our students and the Unico employees by sanctioning an activity as drastic as a hunger strike. Hunger strikes have never been used in this country to oppose an election. We have urged both parties to continue daily discussions until this issue is resolved. A free election, for or against unionization, is a federal statutory right. In the end, the SEIU relented to a federally monitored election. But at what price? 5 SEIU members were hospitalized, one with a minor stroke. Wackenhut Corporation Chief Operating Officer Paul Donahue, expressing sympathy for the University of Miami's plight, saw the big picture. The bullying, protesting, harassment, contrived events and demands will continue indefinitely because the union has millions of dollars in dues money from hardworking janitors and other service workers which can be spent on ruining the reputation of businesses instead of bettering the lives of those workers that contributed. Indeed, no one has felt the blunt force and physical danger of Stern's persuasion of power more than workers themselves. In Oakland, Stern and his Washington crew imposed a trusteeship on a 150,000-member local that had publicly opposed SEIU's strong-arm tactics. The D.C. headquarters, knee-deep in ethical mud, accused the local, known as SEIU United Healthcare Workers West, UHW West, of financial malpractice and misconduct. The local fought back, charging the Beltway union leaders with manufacturing the allegations to retaliate and to distract from Washington mismanagement. The UHW West president, Sal Rosselli, quit the SEIU executive board and formed a new union in February 2009, which declared, were tired of SEIU's hostile tactics, threatening phone calls, their collusion with employers and governors like Blagojevich, and the corruption of Stern's appointees like local 6434 head Tyrone Freeman in Los Angeles, disgraced SEIU executive vice president Anel Grajeda, and the appointees who have just taken over what had been our local. We don't trust them with our contracts. We don't trust them with our dues. We just don't trust them. In Philadelphia, Stern engineered the hostile takeover of a 150,000-member union representing garment and hospitality workers. Workers United had broken off from the national Unite Here union of 450,000 workers. Progressive New York Daily News columnist Juan Gonzalez, citing SEIU's agreement with Workers United, called Stern hell-bent on using classic corporate raider tactics to bring a huge portion of the U.S. labor movement under his absolute control. The pact included discounted member dues and legal and financial assistance to aid the breakaway group's efforts to take control of the Amalgamated Bank, the nation's only union-owned bank. One union official called the power grab a breathtaking form of imperialism. In Portland, Oregon, Ryan Canny, who worked for silicon chip manufacturer Siltronic, was subjected to union coercion and deception by labor organizers using a card check scheme. According to the National Right to Work Foundation, which successfully represented Canny, SEIU Local 49 union officials allegedly tricked Canny and his coworkers into signing information flyers that were later counted as votes favoring unionization. Canny also charged that Siltronics overlooked outdated cards, promised benefits, and otherwise deceived and coerced employees into supporting unionization. The National Labor Relations Board intervened, ordering the local to abandon its fraudulent methods. The same union was involved in a similar attempted hijacking at Kaiser Permanente in Portland. Kaiser employee Karen Mayhew also staved off the deceptive takeover, winning an NLRB settlement that forced SEIU Local 49 officials to renounce their illegally obtained monopoly bargaining power over Kaiser employees and to issue notices to employees alerting them of their legal rights, including the right to refrain from formal union membership, and to inform workers that the company will not bargain with union officials unless the employees choose to do so through the less abusive NLRB secret ballot election process. The abusive system that workers like Ryan Canny, Karen Mayhew, and their colleagues suffered is what Andy Stern wants imposed nationwide and what Barack Obama has promised to make the law of the land as President of the United States through the Orwellian-titled Employee Free Choice Act. It's a system that would dragoon hundreds of thousands of unsuspecting workers into Stern's platoons to transform the political landscape in the most radical and perhaps irreversible way. If Walmart's workforce alone were unionized and captured by SEIU, it would provide an additional 1.4 million bodies and $500 million more in forced dues. As SEIU Queen of Labor Anna Berger herself put it at the SEIU convention in 2008, it is the fuel, the opening for SEIU to change our growth curve from 100,000 to a million or more workers a year. Unchecked corruption, gagged dissenters, corporate blackmail, a massive new infusion of coerced dues spent on big labor lackeys in Washington to seal the deal and a permanent political majority. This is the change they seek. Chapter 8, Obamacorn, a community of organized racketeers nationwide. Donna Hanks gathered friends in front of her foreclosed house in Baltimore to bemoan the ravages of the subprime crisis. Greedy lenders hiked her mortgage payments by $300 in 1 month, the despondent hotel restaurant worker told a local reporter for WJZ-TV. The bank refused to work with her, she explained, and cruelly kicked her to the curb. She was exactly the kind of downtrodden victim Barack Obama had promised to help if elected. One of Hanks's friends, Louis Beverly, stood beside her on the porch. Beverly sported a distinctive acorn patch on his shirt and wielded a pair of red-handled bolt cutters in his hands. With cameras rolling, Beverly used the tool to break a padlock on the front door. He then used his body as a battering ram to bust the door open and boldly declared, "This is our house now." Hanks and her friends, many wearing identical T-shirts declaring a foreclosure-free zone and advertising a hotline number, streamed into the home. The cameras followed. Hanks wistfully toured her old residence, lashed out at the bank for a few more minutes, and then put her own lock on the door to cap off the reclamation. Bertha Lewis, the national president of ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, praised Hanks for taking action to liberate her home from the bank. Lewis Beverly, ACORN's chief Baltimore housing activist, called it a civil disobedience and the right thing to do. The Baltimore police called it fourth-degree burglary and charged both Beverly and Hanks with criminal trespassing. President Obama, the community organizer-in-chief, who cut his teeth as a street activist working with ACORN and its inextricably linked SEIU allies in Chicago, made no public comment. But the left's ground troops know exactly where their comrade in the White House stands. As Obama reminded ACORN leaders after its Political Action Committee endorsed his presidential candidacy in February 2008, "I came out of a grassroots organizing background. That's what I did for 3.5 years before I went to law school. That's the reason I moved to Chicago, was to organize. So this is something that I know personally, the work you do. I've been fighting alongside ACORN on issues you care about my entire career. Even before I was an elected official, when I ran Project Vote voter registration drive in Illinois, ACORN was smack dab in the middle of it, and we appreciate your work." The Baltimore home invasion was part of ACORN's aggressive pressure campaign for a nationwide foreclosure moratorium. Just happened to coincide with the White House launch of massive new government interventions in the housing market unveiled in February 2009. This was a cunning public relations stunt, complete with ACORN banners and apparel to intimidate lenders and recruit new members. The protesters' T-shirts blared 1-866-67-ACORN. Donna Hanks was a seasoned ACORN activist who had successfully pimped her subprime sob story to national media outlets without even minimal vetting. It would have been an opportune moment for the professionals in the mainstream media to illuminate ACORN's trademark shakedown methods and shady activists. It would have been an opportune moment to remind the taxpaying public of how President Obama guaranteed these government-subsidized political operatives a seat at his table of power. "Before I even get inaugurated, during the transition, we're going to be calling all of you in to help us shape the agenda," Obama promised ACORN activists at a December 2007 Democratic presidential rally. "We're going to be having meetings all across the country with community organizations so that you have input into the agenda of the next presidency of the United States of America." But the mainstream media, continuing a decades-old pattern of whitewashing the radical left-wing outfit's activities, failed to report the unvarnished truth about ACORN's racketeers in Baltimore. Here are the facts. Hanks bought the two-story home in the summer of 2001 for $87,000. At some point during the next 5 years, she refinanced the original home loan for $270,000. Where did all that money go? Hint: think house-sized ATM. The property initially went into foreclosure proceedings in the spring of 2006. Hanks soon filed for bankruptcy and agreed to a Chapter 13 plan to pay back her bank and other creditors. In September 2006, the bankruptcy court ordered Hanks' employer to deduct $340 a month from her salary to pay down the debt. Hanks did not comply with the legally binding plan. In December 2007, the loan servicer issued a notice of default on nearly $7,000 past due. While she was reneging on her mortgage IOUs, she managed to collect rent on her basement and rack up a criminal record on charges of theft and second-degree assault. The house was sold only after 2 years of court-negotiated attempts to allow Hanks to dig herself out of her debt hole. Baltimore ACORN leader Lewis Beverly, who also claims to be a foreclosure victim, is a housing thug. He was charged with separate second-degree assault and property destruction in early 2009 and battery, assault, handgun possession, and possession of a deadly weapon with intent to injure in 1992. In 2006, he was slapped with a peace order, According to court records, he owned several rental properties in the Baltimore area and has for years been involved in civil cases alleging failure to maintain property, dumping in uninhabitable conditions. The Washington Post spotlighted Beverly and Hanks's activism without ever following up on their criminal records and financial negligence.